Welcome to the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast. This is number 2, titled Prologue. It is derived from a book I've written called Becoming Human in the Cosmos, The Purpose and Ultimate Destiny of Human Life. This book is available on Amazon for Kindle and such like devices and costs $5. Now, why prologue? In the first 2 editions of Becoming Human in the Cosmos, 2007 and 2011, I agonized over not being able to get to the ultimate original beginning of human life. If we are eternal and immortal creatures, which we are, then how could that which is eternal or immortal have a beginning? By definition, there is no beginning, there is no ending. Well, I agonized with that. There's a story told by Bertrand Russell, who after a lecture was confronted by a woman and told him that the universe rested on the back of a giant turtle. Russell asked her, "Okay, what does that turtle stand on?" And the woman said, "It's no use, sonny. It's turtles all the way down." And I was frustrated because I couldn't get to that bottom turtle. Until I came up with the idea that our very beginnings are potential. Potential can truly be infinite and eternal. And that we began, I believe, at this point anyway, that we began as potentials. Now, of course, various aspects of our lives have beginnings, which can be traced backwards in time. I was born into a mortal flesh and blood body about 74 years ago. And prior to that, I was born as a spirit son of God. As to how far back that goes, that can't be measured in earthly years, for God's time's not our time. But still, there is a trail leading back to that point. Then from there, I, like all life, went back to the time I was classified as an intelligence. How long? Again, I can't say. As to what came before intelligence, I believe potential is the answer, at least for now. My conclusions are temporary, as Paul said, and I quoted earlier, "I see through a glass darkly." Now, the problem is, there can be many potentials bubbling around in this great cauldron, this great roiling sea of life, and somehow, some way, elements must come together and form what can be taken from the abstract of all of this anonymous, amorphous interplay of potential and put into the concrete. When this is done, a certain group of potentials is embodied in what is called intelligence. Now, for lack of a better term, I'm going to use the intelligence capsule. And for the first time in our historical lives, we were me. Everything inside this capsule was me. Everything outside this capsule was not me. And we will note that the biological setup of all earthly life is in that form. Everything inside your skin is you. Everything outside your skin is not you. And your body's immune system is set up to define not you. Anything that is not you is immediately attacked by your body's immune system. We have this kind of provinciality, this kind of protective attitude regarding ourselves, our persons, our individualities. And we know that to make a successful heart transplant or kidney transplant or whatever, the immune system has to be suppressed. Now, as to what an intelligence is, I can't even accurately describe what a spirit is. Energy, a finer material substance than our current coarse and clunky flesh and blood molecules, dark matter, dark energy, I do think an intelligence is our first embodiment as an identifiable entity with individuality and personality. Prior to becoming an intelligence, we were part of a seething, anonymous sea of life, alive, but not really distinguished from our fellows and sisters in that pool. In becoming an intelligence, God gathered us out of that sea and embodied us in, what, a capsule? Well, as I say, that eludes me. Yes, we existed before this embodiment, but there was no real distinguishing between individuals. When the hand of God gave us a separation from the rest of the mix, we became, for the first time in our eternal history, individuals with personalities, identity, and an opportunity to progress even all the way to the level of Him who gave us our new individual lives. In other words, sapience began simultaneously with sentience. I think that's how it went. Ruth Montgomery. Now, Ruth Montgomery is a psychic, and I normally don't have a whole lot of truck with psychics, but she has written a book titled A World Beyond, and on page 12, she says, "Now let us start with the premise that each person is a continuing entity through all eternity, no beginning and no ending. There has never been a time when we were not, and we always will be, even though in constantly changing forms and stages. Those beginnings were all facilitated by a God whom we came to call Father. It was He who embodied us in intelligence, then spirit, now mortal, soon immortal, flesh and bone. For that we call Him a creator, a title He richly deserves, but He didn't create us. The pure essence, the personality, that is our eternal and infinite self. He only created the vehicles, the means for the advancement, the development, and expression of our personalities. God creates for us, like Henry Ford created automobiles for drivers. Ford didn't create the drivers themselves. It's the same thing with parents and children. The mother creates the body for her baby, but the child doesn't come tabula rasa, in other words, a blank slate, a clean white page, ready to be written on. It has its own personality right from the beginning, and any parents who have had two or more children will tell you each one was unique and distinctive right from birth. If you consider the universe, is there not an infinite potential for life? And God, who is the servant of life, remember Christ said, "Let he who is greatest among you be your servant." God dips into this infinite sea of potential, gathers the material ready to be individualized, and embodies that individual into, for lack of a better term, a capsule or intelligence body that is the beginning of its independent and distinguishable life, different from all others of its kind, and all others not of its kind. Thus, dog A is different from dog B, even though they're both dogs, and dog A is definitely different from the master who owns him and cares for him. I think this individuality goes clear down to the single-celled animal level. This then is to say that potential is a living thing, although nebulous, amorphous, anonymous, without form or distinction, from which individual units can be drawn. These units will range in life forms from single-celled on up to and including human. Each with its embodiment as an intelligence will be given the choice to go on to higher life forms or stay where they are. If they choose to stay, then they will be given a spirit body, and ultimately, as time and their progression winds on, mortal, then immortal bodies accordingly. This potential has always existed, will always exist, and will be an infinite, undepletable well from which to draw new life. To say that God created the human personality is to say he created Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin. No. He just embodied their potentials as intelligence, then spirit, then mortal bodies, and gave them the freedom to express themselves for good or evil. As I will say in many places throughout this work, God is the God of all life, and he can't cherry-pick those personalities who get advancement in life and who don't. That's one of the burdens of being God. You are the servant of all life and have to accommodate all life forms. As it says in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. It is impossible to create light without creating darkness, good without creating evil. There must be an opposition in all things. See Book of Mormon, page 57. If one wants to be a god, one must be reconciled to the fact that you must accommodate all life forms. From Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler to Gandhi and Mother Teresa. Now, a side observation here. This is the opposite of what the Buddhists teach. They teach, if I understand correctly, that the ultimate goal is to shed ourselves of our individuality and personality and be poured back into that great sea of being. Now, if you were to pour a glass of water into the ocean, could you ever recover that water, every molecule that was in that glass? Of course not. It's lost. It's gone. It's immersed. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity says it thus, page 141. They say it is like a drop of water slipping into the sea, but of course that is the end of the drop. If that is what happens to us, then being absorbed is the same as ceasing to exist. It is only the Christians who have any idea of how human souls can be taken into the life of God and yet remain themselves. In fact, be very much more themselves than they were before. We are pulled from this anonymous sea of potential, given the opportunity to be an individual with a personality all our own, unique to the universe, and the chance provided by our Father to develop and grow that personality. As Brigham Young, the Mormon prophet, stated, paraphrase, salvation is the means of preserving your personality unto the Lord, not having it destroyed and subsumed back into that great sea of being. That's going backwards as far as I'm concerned, with all due respect to Buddhists and apologies to them. And besides, one of the major factors in our spiritual development is our struggle to choose good over evil. If we didn't have evil accompanying us, giving us choice, we'd never develop into the great spiritual beings we have the potential to become. By giving embodiment to evil potential, God accomplishes two things. He accommodates all life forms and creates the opposition necessary for our development. God did not create the personalities of Satan and his angels, but he did create their intelligence bodies, then spirit bodies, just as he did for us. They are life too, and must have their place in this cosmos. When I think about these things, I usually wind up saying to myself, it really can't be any other way. The problem with evil, as I write in my journal, is its tendency to encroach. It is not happy being confined and wants to spread throughout the cosmos. It must be encircled and controlled. That is done by giving it such places to exist as hell and having guardian angels that watch to see they don't step over their boundaries. See Betty Eady's comments on warring angels in Chapter 5 of the book Becoming Human in the Cosmos. An off-the-wall example. At the beginning of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln would have been content to let the evil of slavery exist where it did in the South. But the Southerners wanted to expand it to the Western states, California, Nevada, Oregon, and ultimately, by dint of majority in the national legislature, expand it to the entire country. Had they been content with Lincoln's ideas, that particular evil could have been contained in the South for who knows how much longer. This most certainly is not an endorsement of slavery. I have called it an evil, have I not? But had the South gone with Lincoln's ideas, it would have saved them much death and destruction. Thus it is that we must see ourselves not as helpless created toys of an omniscient and omnipotent creator, but as eternal and distinct individuals coexisting with God from eternity, as Joseph Smith revealed in his King Follett sermon. Thus we can't blame God for our shortcomings and sins, our natures and characteristics. He didn't create us to be nitwits. He just gave us the embodied life and means to express fully our personalities and individualities and proclivities for good or for evil. Therefore, we must take responsibility for who and what we are, and not try to blame God. He will, if we so desire and request, help us to be better and more advanced human beings, but he won't, he can't, force his ideals of righteousness on us. We have to come up to his standards via his invitation and guidance, not by his coercion. I have a whole chapter dealing largely with the evils of coercion, so this idea will get further development later. Those who might cry out, "Change me, God," if they listen, might hear the answer, "No, you change yourself. I will help in that project, but I will not, I cannot, I must not fool with your individuality and personality. I can only guide and help you to make the best of it as you come unto me and ask for my help." What objection to God being omnipotent, all-powerful, and omniscient, all-knowing, is that he, therefore, has no limits? I take issue with that. He, through his infinite wisdom, self-limits for the good of the cause. And do we not all self-limit in one way or another? We push ourselves away from the dinner table, saying, "There, that's enough for me." And when we perhaps decide not to see someone anymore, saying, "That's enough of that person for me," we, at least most of us, have the wisdom to self-limit. Surely, God does too. And for those who will say, "I am limiting God, making him powerless over evil, and denying him the title creator," I can only say I think this is how it is, and I can't see it as being any other way and making sense. My feelings and thoughts on these subjects have not destroyed my belief in God, nor my attempts to keep his commandments and serve as I see best in what I believe to be his kingdom, and have made me much more aware of my humanity and potential to be like God, and much more grateful to him for the help he gives me in my development, and for his magnanimity in extending a hand out to aid me in coming up to his levels. He truly is a great God. I would say humble, loving, wise, beneficial, and a credit to the race, the human race, and above all else, our Father. And now, just for the fun of it, I'm going to give space to three other opinions on the beginnings of life, starting with that of Dr. Jordan Peterson, psychologist and author of 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, wherein he alludes that it all begins with idea. Are his idea and my potential the same thing? Well, I'll just put his writings out here and let you figure it out. I am not yet to the point where I consider my opinions to be the only game in town. Peterson writes, "An idea that grips a person is alive. It wants to express itself, to live in the world. An idea has an aim. It wants something. It posits a value structure. An idea believes that what it is aiming for is better than what it has now. It reduces the world to those things that aid or impede its realization, and it reduces everything else to irrelevance. My concept of me and not me, with our immune defense systems? Who knows? An idea is a personality, not a fact. When it manifests itself within a person, it has a strong proclivity to make of that person its avatar, to impel that person to act it out." Page 195. See also the last chapter of this work on creativity. So life begins as idea, potential. Perhaps they are interchangeable. In either case, they are both individual entities seeking embodiment for the expression of their selves, and they each satisfy our need to be both immortal and eternal, and yet to have beginnings, keeping our individuality and personality intact. As a follow-up to the above in a subsequent book, Beyond Order, 12 More Rules for Life, Peterson writes, "You do not choose what interests you. It chooses you." Now that, I think, is a profound idea. I'm going to repeat it. Page 65 in that book. You do not choose what interests you. It chooses you. I think, as I have prepared over decades to write Becoming Human in the Cosmos, the purpose and ultimate destiny of life, of human life, as I read books from various, as I read books from various studies and fields and put them together with kind of a vague idea of someday putting the whole thing together into a book on the universe and what it's all about, I think that idea was choosing me. This gives me to think that ideas and thoughts are living, breathing things and looking for avatars, us, to give them tangible life. If they have the ability to choose and select those whom they think will give them embodiment, then we have a pretty good, albeit broad, definition of what constitutes life. And here is a cautionary note. Since there must be an opposite to all things, then we must assume there are evil ideas that seek us out as well, hoping for embodiment. Such evil ideas achieved embodiment in Hitler and Stalin, as we mentioned earlier. I'm using the above quote twice in this work, this time to show a possible life form, later to give us a look into finding meaning in our lives, and an additional look to establish for sure that I'm not the only game in town, reading Lewis Thomas, The Fragile Species. He has these thoughts on the beginnings of intelligence, page 103. Anytime you have a system made up of huge numbers of communicating agencies continually engaged in a systematic mechanism for passing information back and forth and all around, you may have the makings of an intelligence. I'm not sure he's using intelligence in the same manner God is, but his choice of words does stand out to me. He goes on to relate that bacteria have that ability to pass along information via the DNA molecules that viruses carry from one bacteria to another, and that information, regrettably, such things as immunity, can be passed on to other bacteria colonies at remarkable speed as they become resistant to our latest lines of antibiotic defense. Recently, when the notion of how to resist certain antibiotics popped into the plasmids of bacteria in some New York City hospitals, in almost no time, the news had spread like gossip to similar bacteria in Peru, Australia, and Japan. How did they do that? Bacteria spreading information literally around the world in short time. Amazing. He says they carry the information quicker than overnight mail, and that bacterial plasmids may be taken as metaphors for tiny ideas. Back to Jordan Peterson. And now these last thoughts on the beginnings of life from Betty Eady, Embraced by the Light, cut and pasted from the 2011 edition of Cosmos. Note my previous struggles with the bottom turtle, as we mentioned earlier. Melvin Morse, quoted abundantly in this book, is about to be hauled into this nebulous arena, forgive me, good doctor, in Where God Lives, page 42, Morse says, "The theoretical physicists that I work with at Los Alamos have explained to me that the energy we give off in the form of thought and behavior does not disappear, but survives somewhere in nature." Betty Eady, opposite, adds additional insight on the relation of thought to creation. Because our thoughts can affect this eternal energy, they are the source of creation. All creation begins in the mind. It must be thought first. Page 58. We would say, well, of course, you have to think about something before you actually put hammer and saw to wood and build it. But I don't think that's what she means, though I don't want to put words in her mouth. I gather from this that once a thought is thought, it takes on a life of its own, or at least the beginning energies of sentience that later on get asked by God, "Do you wish to be magnified?" Added upon. To add my uninspired extrapolation to these quotes, I think where everything begins, at least for us, we're back to turtles again, and I can't for the life of me get to the bottom one. Now remember, that was from the 2011 edition. I got to what I now claim to be the bottom turtle in this updated version, the 2019 Legacy Edition of Becoming Human in the Cosmos. I wonder if all life forms don't begin with thoughts and behaviors which create energies that don't disappear, but continue forever. Is this maybe where life begins? In an upcoming chapter, we'll discuss a vision that shows the very beginnings of life as a mass of light called the Light of Intelligence, from which we were all drawn and had the initiation of our progression up to creation in the image and likeness of God, for those who chose to go all the way. Is this cloud of light the repository of all thoughts, or now, in the latest edition, I would add potential? And Peterson might kick in, wait a minute, what about ideas? Do our thoughts actually begin life? What a responsibility for us to think great thoughts. Are any of the thoughts in this book worthy of life form status beyond the level of clam? Well, probably not my thoughts anyway, but the thoughts of those who I've been able to read and research and bring here in quotes may well have been the origins of great life forms to be. And think of the exponential growth of life in the cosmos, if such is so. If a thought begins a life that can have thoughts, and how many thoughts does the average person have in a mortal lifetime? Then the beginning life forms created from just one sentient life form explodes with a numerical force that makes a mere exponential extrapolation rise on a level equivalent to the minimum wages of an unskilled laborer. Is it any wonder that the cosmos is ever expanding, that baby universes are coming online all the time, and planets are evolving out of the primordial furnace of infinite Big Bangs? There must be room created for all this new life. One wonders if even a truly infinite God can keep a handle on all this. It gives whole new breathtaking scope to the idea of infinity, doesn't it? And how about these thoughts? Have I just given existence to a few ants, a tumbleweed, maybe a skunk? If so, I hope they avoid me. I don't want to be known as their creator. It's remotely possible I've gotten to our bottom turtle. If it's true, we begin with a thought. But the obvious question remains, who thought that thought? Damn turtles again. So, our beginnings were as potentials, thoughts, ideas. Are they all the same concept, only under different words? And thus we conclude this, our second podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon. The next podcast will be titled The Eschatological Outlook, Think Like God, and will show us the importance of thinking like God so we can understand Him and overcome some of our negative ideas about God, especially the God of the Old Testament, as seen by some as mean and vicious and cruel and vindictive. Not at all. But we have to learn to think like God. And we will begin to do that in discussion number 3. Thank you for tuning in. And I want to thank once again my technical guy, Craig Whitmore, who is putting this together for me. Thank you, Craig. Couldn't do this without you.